Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. My guest today is a regular fixture on the best of lists for any year that she publishes a book, including Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Roundups, as well as a whole bunch more. She's also one of those writers that when you say her name, people repeat it back to you all excited and demand that you read her if you haven't already. It's like one of those really funny callbacks. So please welcome Joanna Shoup.
Hello. That was what a lovely introduction. Wow.
It is really funny when I say your
name. Can I hire you?
That's your bio now. No,
yeah.
It does really happen though. Like I've said, oh, do you mean Joanna Shoup? Joanna Shoup. Oh my God. You have to read her. I'm like, okay, it's on the list.
So, that's so nice.
You inspire a reaction.
That's very, very nice to hear. I mean, I sort of feel like I exist in like this little no man's land of, like metadata that gets lost, you know,
because yeah.
I don't write in Regency England, so.
Yeah. Right. So you kind of, isn't that funny, though? We all feel, it's so funny how oftentimes people are like, oh, yeah, nobody knows who I am. Like, everyone knows who they are. But
right.
It's so hard to judge, like, where you fall in the ethos of historical romance or romance in general. Like, I think it's really hard to tell, especially with social media, where it's like a book that's just out, like everybody's talking about that. And if you don't have a book out right the second, maybe they're not talking about you. But then the second you have a book out, suddenly you're like, people are talking about you. So I think it's always kind of hard. Plus we're so isolated anyway, as writers.
Right. And there's so, and there's a lot of people writing. I mean,
yeah, there's a lot of us.
There's a lot out there. I mean,
even more now.
Yeah.
Than there were when I started, which is
yes.
a good thing, I think. I mean, I think that having that very wide breadth of voices and experiences and genres and all that stuff is a better thing. I'd much rather
for
have
sure.
people have lots of choices, but it does make discoverability a lot harder.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, especially what we've seen with the explosion of self-publishing and just everybody being able to have a seat at the table, I think, has been really important and necessary in romance. So here's to seeing it continue.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I want to see more and more and more and wider and wider and wider, because I've said this on this before, but it's not pie. It's not like there's a limited amount of
right.
Like, well, if someone buys your book, they'll never buy my book, so I must destroy you. Like, that
yes,
isn't the way that
sure.
it works. Like, I mean, if someone buys your book and there's some theme in it, since we don't write the same subgenre, that's something similar to mine, and then they're looking for that theme and they find mine, like, all I can do is benefit from your success. I can never actually be damaged by it.
Right. Totally. And the great thing about romance is that there is literally something for everyone. You like Vikings?
Mm-hmm.
Great. You like, you know, mail order brides? Great. You like, you know, Regency.
You've certainly got plenty of that.
You've certainly got plenty of that. You know, I mean, they're really, and just the explosion of kind of own voices stories that we're seeing now, especially in historicals, which is really a trend that I'm super, super excited about, means that there's just even more stories that, you know, that can be told.
Yeah. And should have been being told all of this time, but there wasn't an outlet because traditional publishing wasn't necessarily as open for it.
Right.
You know, I often think about when we talk about diversity, especially in historical romance, like how many of those stories were just lost? Like
right.
people just gave up. You know, they wrote a story that didn't fit into whatever traditional publishing was buying in 1998 or 2004 or 1976. And there was no place to go. And so they just stopped writing entirely,
yeah.
or stopped writing something that meant something to them as a writer, or, you know, just stopped writing for public consumption, like only wrote stuff for themselves and now have 47 books, you know, in a box somewhere.
Right.
That they should publish.
Right.
You should publish those now.
Right. I mean, that's a little bit like how I sort of got started, was because I knew that I would never be able to sell a Gilded Age series straight out of the box. I mean, I wrote a Regency series thinking, okay, this, you know,
that'll be the door.
Yeah. You want to play the game. This is the game. You write yep. a Regency series. And so I just came up with like just the most old school, bonkers, crazy idea that I could, and just hoping that I could get a publisher that would take a risk on a, on me, mm-hmm. and that I would build enough of a brand that when I said, hey, listen, I have this crazy idea for an American set, you know, historical series back in Gilded Age New York, what do you think, that they would take a risk on it? And luckily, Kensington did that.
Yeah, so you kind of stepped around the the barrier in some right. way. Like, you found a way to step around it.
Right.
Which has worked out very well in your favor, because, I mean, so for people that don't know what the Gilded Age is, it's sort of like late Victorian, but set in the United States. Is that kind
Correct.
Of an appropriate definition?
100%. Yeah. It's yeah. really like 1870-ish to 1910.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the Progressive Age, the Industrial Age, you know, the age of, you know, corruption and money sort of in the late 19th century, when we really see America just explode with technology and construction and railroads and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. Corruption of money. I wonder how that
how did that work out?
Yeah, it's going great. It's going great, everybody.
Yeah.
Capitalism is going great. No, it is funny, though, the callbacks of that, you know, of specifically that time in the United States. And now it's like, oh, here we are.
It's just, I mean, I feel like I could go on and on. I mean, the concentration of wealth at the top, the rules against immigration, the rollback of the rights of women. I mean, it's just, it is a playbook. And I can tell you, as somebody who has studied this era a lot, it doesn't end well. So,
right.
You know, hopefully we course correct soon. But I mean, the parallels between then and now are staggering.
Yeah, it really is. And I think you said at some point, you know, like Regency and Victorian English set historical is still what traditional publishing is buying for the most part at this point. And it is still selling well. I mean, I write Regency, so, you know, I'm definitely part of the problem. But it's just like, you know,
it's not a problem.
That's not the way to put it. But I mean, you know, like that is still what they consider marketable. And I think what readers, because publishers have only published that for the most part in the last 20 years, 30 years, 109 years, that's what readers have an expectation that they're going to find in a historical. So finding something that's Gilded Age or finding something that's different is either very exciting or very confusing to them, I would assume.
Yes, right.
But that we sort of pick that sort of English early 19th to late 19th century almost in a way to sort of avoid those parallels in the United States. Like, by writing in an American setting, you're almost like being forced to look at your American history that
yes.
maybe isn't the most beautiful American history that we want to see.
That you say that, because I have had people say, several people on different occasions say to me, wow, when are you going to write Regencies again? I don't read anything set in America, and I would really love something, you know, to read something by you. And of course, like, you know, I have to, because I'm a journalist at heart, I'm like, why do you tell me more? Like, why do you feel that
pick
way?
Pick your brain, like, as to why you're it, like that.
Yeah. Like, what is it about American set historicals that, I mean, you're not reading Miss Bev, you're not reading Alyssa Cole, you're not reading Rebel Carter. I mean, you're not reading Piper Hughley. Like, if you're telling me you're not going to read American set historicals, like, whoa. So, and they have said, because I can't romanticize our history like I can theirs. I don't know their history. And, you know, and I know American history too well. And that, to me, I mean, first of all, nobody knows American history like you should know America. You know what I'm saying? Like, we
right,
think
because
we know
so
American
much
history.
Has been erased or whitewashed.
Correct.
Or that huge swaths of history are completely erased, and so we don't really know anything about
right.
ourselves, or and we choose to continue along with that path. This is
right.
That's fine. I'm very excited not to know anything about the worst parts of us.
Well, right, and the British history, you know, how did the Dukes all get their money? I mean,
yep.
we don't want to think about that. We think about Georgette Heyer and, you know, Jane Austen, mm-hmm. and so yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you said. So, you know, I just And every book, I try to bring something that I think readers might not know about American history.
Yeah.
You know, I just try to pick, like, whether it's the Chinese Exclusionary Act or whether it's the spiritualism movement or, like, the women that were, you know, trying to trade on the stock exchange that were prevented from doing so. Or, I mean, I just try to pick, like, one thing that hopefully that readers will read it and go, oh, no way, no way did this happen. And then they'll get to the acknowledgments and I'll tell them, hey, guess what? It totally did. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not trying to lecture anybody, but I hope that it forces maybe one or two people to go, wow, I would like to, you know, learn more about XYZ and, like, go out and research it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard in the historical sense of, I mean, I was just speaking to another historical author who I won't name because she didn't tell me I could. And we were both saying, like, how difficult it is right now to write historical, like the struggle, the internal struggle of, I mean, I wrote a series in 2017, 2018, with 10 extremely handsome dukes with all their teeth who were young. So already, like, throwaway, just a lot of reality right there.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, audiences, oh my God, I love dukes. But yeah, I mean, it is a constant worm in your head that says this is written on the backs of white supremacy. And so how do, you know, I mean, that is the struggle now of, you know, acknowledgement of that. And then how do we as historical authors still write a romantic story that people can get lost in and forget about their own troubles personally in this moment, and at the same time not shy away from whitewash or erase the truth of those things? And that is the balance. And I like that at least we're having these conversations. And a lot of times on this show, when we talk about diversity, it's when I'm talking to Black authors, which is an incredibly unfair thing that only Black authors are, or authors of color, are the ones that have to talk about this, and that we as white authors don't talk about it. So right. I mean, I'm sort of glad that it's sort of come up as a topic, because you have explored those issues much more deeply than, I mean, I can admit, than I have explored. I mean, you talked about the Chinese Exclusion Act, and you talk about that in your book Mogul. So how do you feel like you do that balance of talking about something that's an incredibly important and dark piece of our history, and their main characters very tied up in that book, but also still having that balance where it isn't a lecture? I mean, is there a magic formula that you're tell us the magic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I try to think about the world building as well. Mm-hmm. What I struggle with, and what I'm still struggling with, is New York in the Gilded Age. When I personally think of New York, I think of it today, that it's just this melting pot where on every street corner, there are all different nationalities and all different races and ethnicities and colors. And it is, in my mind, that is what New York City is.
That vibrancy.
Right. But actually, in the 19th century, unfortunately, it was very segregated by neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Like Five Points, kind of the Bowery, would have been one of the only places where you would have seen kind of cross ethnicities, cross, you know, cultures. So I try to, in the world building of the books, to... And I don't, it's whether it's historically accurate or not, to have characters of color that interact with my main characters. I don't feel like I'm the right person as a white cis het lady to write, you know, a Black hero or heroine or a Chinese hero or heroine. I don't feel like that is my
Right. You don't want to take someone else's story.
Exactly.
And then filter it through
my lens.
Right. Our lens, our very white lens.
Right.
And then suddenly you're, it is that balance. But bringing in the secondary characters. And I thought it was interesting that you said whether or not it's historically accurate. And that's always this argument of, but is that historically accurate? That, which it is, A. But B, even if it is not, neither is 10 hot dukes all being best friends.
So, right, correct.
Why is the one an acceptable lack of historical accuracy and the other one is not? If you feel absolutely certain as a reader or as a writer that this is historically inaccurate, why is the thing that is also historically inaccurate appropriate, but the other thing isn't?
I mean, exactly. You're exactly right. So I do try to think about the world building, what they're seeing on the streets, and I try to make it as diverse as I can. Am I doing enough? No. Am I trying to do better? Yes. It's something that I struggle with, but I do try to think about it.
Yeah, and I think that's really, obviously, all of this is often first steps, is that how can I diversify my world? And then doing that. And I mean, Laquette does a great class about expanding your lens.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, if people are listening and they're writing and they're cishet white ladies like us and they want to explore, you know, expanding their universe, that is a great class to take.
Yeah, she's giving it in the Beaumont, I think, coming up soon.
Yes. So, you know, you may still be able to register. You'd want to check that out, and you can go to Laquette's website, and she's been on this podcast as well.
Yes, so. She's brilliant.
She's so brilliant and so patient. So patient. But, you know, I mean, at least if we all make that effort, I think that it is doing a service to all of our readers, because, you know, we are missing big gaps in our history, and reading in a fictional world is a big part of how we fill those gaps in. So
right. And if you're writing a story where they're, you know, you're talking, your character is on the docks, the London docks. I mean, yes, there would have been tons of different ethnicities there.
Yes.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, so I think it's also thinking about where you place your characters in order to be able to, you know, really get like a good sense of time and place and who would have been there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it has to be intentional, I think, is what I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, that's true. It has to be intentional.
Yeah. So yeah, for me, it's a lot about thinking about the world building.
Yeah, no. And I like that. That's the way that you put it, is that concept of the world building. And then once you've built the world to be an appropriate representation and reflection of what was really going on, then it becomes a lot easier to find characters that actually fit into that world. And if the world that you've created is only, it has a very narrow lens, it will feel clunkier to realistically reflect how the world existed.
Right. And I won't put in an African-American character as a servant. You know what I'm saying? Like, I also think about,
again, intentionality.
Yes. I mean, where they, you know, an Indian, servant, or like I just try to think about, not only, you know, if I am putting in ancillary characters, you know, who are they, you know, and really, try not to.
Well,
make
how is
it...
a mod? I mean, it's a modern readership that's reading your book, and so,
right.
You know, I mean, that's the other balance of it, is that as a modern reader, people are used to reading more diversely, and you don't want that sort of the most basic or wrong representation, where it's like, oh great, all the servants are black. Thanks, that's really helpful.
Right,
like
exactly.
That doesn't make it better. That doesn't make it more diverse or more reflective of reality. And again, I mean, it's all balance. And I mean, I think as historical writers, because especially in Regency, I mean, you know, our four bearers are not exactly writing diverse stories. So, you know, it's expanding that look of the world to have people realize, oh wait, this whole era was not white. So I'm becoming accustomed to realizing that diversity has always existed.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure there are authors, you know, writing in that period, like a Vanessa Riley or,
yes.
I'm guessing, and I don't want to speak for any of them, but I'm sure they get pushback from people saying didn't really happen, you know.
Oh, I'm sure all the time.
Can't be true. But
yeah,
of course it's true. Of course mm-hmm. it happened. Yeah. So
do you get, obviously this is a very different issue, but have you said that you wrote the Regency series first, Kensington bought that, and then sort of turn that corner into the Gilded Age. do they ever try to push you back to Regency just because it is something that more people understand?
They did. I think not in any overt way, but I think that would have been their preference. But forces just kind of all collided in that I moved over to Avon, mm-hmm. who was very eager, you know, for Gilded Age, because my editor is Tessa Woodward.
Oh, okay.
And she said she edited one of the nonfiction books, I think about the Astor family. And she said, it just sells and sells and sells. And she said, I know people like that time period and are interested in it. So she said, I think the time is right. Like, let's see what we can do together. And the first series for Avon, which was the 400 Club, she was, or the 400 series, I don't think it was 400. Isn't that four? What am I thinking of? 400 Club. Isn't that some religious show? Definitely not that.
Like, not that. No.
It was the 400 series.
It's a whole new audience for you.
Right. It's a very, very different book. She really wanted to have British heroines and American heroes. So she sort of wanted like a, you know, to bring the reader
kind of straddling that Victorian, more traditional over into this Gilded Age.
Exactly.
That's smart.
Exactly. So it was very like half British, half American by design.
Mm-hmm.
Really wanted, you know, like the upper crust society heroes, so that, you know, you kind of got a feel for the upper class of New York City at the time. So that was sort of the design of the first series. And then the next series, which is the series that's finishing up now, was by design your lower Manhattan heroes, the slash criminals, and
I always love those.
Right. And the uptown heiresses.
Uptown girls.
Yeah. So, you know, just trying to mix it up and show different areas of the city and different issues that people were dealing with at the time. And it's such a fascinating time in America, and such a, you know, interesting, I mean,
well, it's a very dynamic time.
For sure.
Because of the technology, because of the
immigration,
And I mean, there's a lot happening at that time, and it's got to be a lot of fodder for interesting true history sort of being brought into it.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I discover something new all the time. I mean, it's just,
well, it's very much written about as well. I mean, because it is such a dynamic time, there's so many books about different aspects of that time,
yeah,
in the United States.
And what's great is because of, you know, the advent of photography at the time. I mean, I've got photographs and all of Edison. Edison took tons of movies. So, I mean, you know, in the 1890s, you have all those photographs and moving pictures. I mean, there's just tons of actual,
the wealth of,
yeah, tangible, original, tangible research. Yeah, original research
source,
materials.
Real source. Yeah. So were you always a big reader then when you were growing up?
I was. I've read romance from a very, very early age, probably earlier than I should have. and I always say that the reason that I love to write in the Gilded Age is because I read Edith Wharton long before I read Jane Austen. I mean, I didn't read Austen until I was in my 30s. So I read Edith Wharton and I just fell in love with, you know, her descriptions of old New York. And
yeah,
my great-great-grandparents came through Ellis Island from Italy. So I've always felt like a connection to both that time period and New York City itself. But always, you know, Johanna Lindsay and Amanda Quick and, I mean, all of those early, I mean, Julie Garwood and, all of those early Jude Devereaux. I mean, all of those early authors, I devoured those.
Was that something that like your mom or aunts or anything like that were doing, or just something you kind of discovered on your own?
Well, I have a very early memory of my grandmother lived in Southern Kentucky, and we would go down for the summers almost every single year. My sister and I would spend the summer at her house, and she was an avid romance reader, and she had them in her bookshelf. And I want to say that's where I discovered them, was in her bookshelves. And then
once you start, then it's like,
well, right. Right.
Well, I will find this.
And then my mom is a huge romance reader. And so between like the two of them, there were always paperbacks around to read.
And when did you start writing? Not writing romance necessarily, but just, was that also something that you always kind of were doing, or was that something that came later?
Well, I went to college to be a sports journalist. So I got a journalism degree. I've always...
So different always kind of writing.
Yes. I've always been writing, but wanted to go specifically into sports journalism, which didn't work out because of basically misogyny, but that's sure. Like a whole other podcast we could do.
Part two. Misogyny in sports, coming soon.
Yeah.
I'm sure that comes as a shock to literally no one to this, but
right, exactly.
That's the whole podcast, guys.
Oh, my God. And so when I graduated from college, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I moved back in with my parents, and I was living at home, and I was waiting tables. And so I would come home at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I would be totally wired and unable to go to sleep. And I was reading a ton of romances. And my oldest sister, who's, you know, like 12 years older than me, said, "You should try to write one of those. I bet you'd be really good at it. And how hard could it be?"
Yeah, that's what.
She goes, "I'll help you come up with the plot, and then you just write it. I mean, it's, seems like it
there
just writes
go.
Itself.
Wham bam, thank you, ma'am."
Yeah. If only.
Oh my God, wouldn't that be easy? Great?
Yeah.
Or as easy as you thought it would be before you tried it.
Right. So I came home from waiting tables every night at like 1 a.m. and I would write until like 4 or 4:30, and then I would sleep until noon and rinse and repeat.
Yeah.
Until I finally had this book. And I let my sister, she got first crack at it because she had helped me with the plot. And she gave me the best compliment I think I've ever gotten. One of the best compliments. And it was, she read it. She said, "I don't know where you came up with half of the stuff that's in here." She said, "I'm so impressed. Like, where did this come from?" And I was like, "Oh, I have no idea. It just like, it's just there.
Out of me."
Yeah. So, you know, she read it. My mom read it. They thought it was great. And then I just put it under the proverbial mattress. And I moved to Chicago and I got a job in sports radio, actually, coincidentally. And sort of forgot about the book. Because, I mean, at that point, you could make a career out of that. I mean, it just seemed...
Right. Do real people do that as a job?
No, it
like
just seems...
It seems crazy.
Right. It still does.
It does. It's weird. Right. I'm fairly certain it's going to fall out from under me any second.
Yes, right. I know. I share that same fear.
Terrible.
So I forgot about it for years and years and years. And I always had it because I had it, you know, it was on the days of like the hard disks. So yeah. I had it on the hard disk.
Nice.
And it would come with me wherever I moved. And I ended up moving to New York and it came with me. The book is still there. And I started dating this man who is now my husband, who is a type A, very type A personality. And owns his own business, you know, go-getter. And I used to come home from work. I was working for a Broadway theatrical producer in marketing. And I would come home and I would flop on his couch and just veg out and watch TV. And he was like, listen, you know, like, come on. Is there, let's get you, do you have any hobbies? Like, is there anything you want to do other than just like lay around? And, you know, at the time I mean, on one hand, I appreciated like the nudge to, you know,
expand
horizon. Yes, exactly, expand my mind,
but also, on the other hand, jerk, can I just watch TV?
Yeah, like, back off, buddy. I sort of said, thinking that, you know, just to like shut him up, well, I have a romance novel that I wrote and someday I may try to get it published, you know, so back off, buddy. And he, in his youth, ran a alternative music magazine. And he knows a lot about editing and writing. And he said, that's amazing. Get it out. I'll help you edit it and try to sell it. Like, what are you waiting for?
This is the one he married, right? For sure.
Right.
That's great.
Right. So,
you're like, well, we're married now.
we are married now. And I tease him about this all the time. And he's like, yeah, if I hadn't helped you. No, I'm just kidding. He doesn't say that. He thinks it loudly, I'm sure. Right. He is extremely supportive. But anyway, so he did. I got it out and I printed it out and he went through it with me and helped me, you know, stitch it together because it was on like 6 hard disks, and sure, then helped me with the editing. And I then at that point I was like, well, I guess I should look into like
what do you do now?
Yeah. Like, are there romance writer groups? Like, how do these people, do they talk to each other? Like, how does it work? So then I found the Romance Writers of America, New York City chapter. And I didn't join, but I kind of like looked at them, you know, longingly from a distance. So then we moved out to New Jersey. And when we moved out to New Jersey, I said, okay, I'm going to do it. Like, I'm in with both feet. I don't know anybody in this state. You know, I've got nothing else to do. I'm just going to jump in with both feet. And I joined New Jersey Romance Writers. And that really taught me about the business. I met other writers. I figured out, like, the game. And I think I joined, I think in 2010, I landed my agent in 2012. It might have, actually, it was 2011, and then got the offer from Kensington in 2013 and won the Golden Heart in 2013, and then I was published in 2015. So that's
once
like
you
very...
kind of pushed the ball down, it was like, okay, now we're going.
Right. I mean, yes. I mean, once I got rolling, it was like, okay, like, if we're going to do it, let's do it. Like, I'm not going to stick a toe in this water. I'm going to just cannonball in and let's go.
I think in some ways that's almost better because you almost like, you don't question yourself as much when you're just like, and I'll just hurtle off this cliff because you're either going to figure it out or you're going to crash. And like, these are your two options versus I think when you pick at it for too long, sometimes you can talk yourself in and out of like good ideas.
Absolutely. Totally. Absolutely. I mean, I think if I had it to do over again where I just could sit and agonize and think about every single move that I made and everything I did, I mean, yeah, I'm sure I would have stalled at some point, but I'm either too stupid to really think anything through, or I don't know, bold. I don't know what to say about that.
2011-ish, 2012, 2013, sort of like in that early sort of publishing process where you're submitting and you get an agent and you sell and book comes out. I mean, that's really at the time of, you know, the real indie revolution and self-publishing revolution. And I know that most of what you've done has been traditionally published. I think all of what you've done, except for is maybe there a collection or something here and there with other people. But is that right?
Right.
But
yeah.
So was that something that you ever considered, or were you more focused on traditional?
I was focused on traditional only because I don't know that I have the business savvy for self-publishing.
Right.
Especially like just starting out. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm, you know,
it's a very different thing to build an audience 100% from the ground up versus coming from having an audience coming from a traditional publisher, for sure.
Right.
Whenever people ask me like, how do you build an audience? I'm like, I don't know. I wrote like 20 books for Avon and it wasn't a great experience, but I got an audience, so I don't know. Like, I don't know.
Right.
I mean, it is a very different math problem. And especially the further along we go. And again, we just talked about it earlier. Discoverability is a lot harder.
Yeah. Did you feel like you knew the business enough to say, okay, this is what I need. I need, you know, an awesome cover. I need an awesome blurb. I need a great editor. I mean,
I had been publishing my first book with Avon came out in 2005 and I went entirely indie in 2015. So I had about 10 years of actual publishing and, under my belt. And also just, I knew that it wasn't that I never thought I would make mistakes, but I knew I would fix them right away, which isn't always what happens in a traditional or semi-traditional environment. You know, I mean, if something, there's some point I had a book out, not actually from HarperCollins, but from a different publisher, and they had mismetadated it. And then we told them and they didn't fix it for like 3 weeks. So of course all your momentum crashes. You know, and it's like, well, we fixed it. And it's like, great, because it's over now.
Yeah.
It's done now.
That's
so, I mean,
really
those sorts of things, I felt like I might do them, but I could immediately go in and sort of fix them. And also, to be fair, I mean, Michael, by that point, my husband was working full time for me, and he was managing a lot of that stuff. So between the two of us, I mean, he's very technical. He used to work from Microsoft.
Oh, nice.
And so I think between the two of us, we had enough that we could either figure stuff out that we didn't know or we already knew it. So, I mean, again, it's like you come from, it's hard because it's like there's so much privilege to all of the levels of all of this. You know
right.
what I mean? When you, there's just things where it's like, I can't tell everyone should self-publish and they're going to do great because I had a whole bunch of circumstances that made it easier for me. You know, versus like talking about building from the ground up. I just know at that
right.
time, like, you know, like that was becoming such a big thing. And so it's always interesting to me. And I think to people that listen, like why people decide the paths that they pick. I don't think there's any right answer to any path, to be honest. I mean, because
right.
there's so many good reasons to traditionally publish. Like you said, I mean, you don't have to be into the minutia of the 17,000 things that have to be done for a book to work. You don't really have to be in the minutia of that beyond just some of your own self-promotion and writing a good book and making sure you hit your deadlines. I mean, those are the things you really have to focus on when you're traditionally published.
Right.
And then there's a machine that sort of takes over a lot of the other elements of that. And there are benefits to that machine for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I know, you know, there are times where I have contemplated it and just
yeah.
thought, you know, but there seemed to be not so much more right now, but maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago, when all you heard was, indie pubbing historicals, you know, the readers don't buy it. You know, the indie readers want sexy contemporary billionaires, you know, sci-fi, but the historical reader is the one that's in Barnes & Noble. And I never believed that was true. And I feel like you know, Christy Caldwell, some of the other really prolific and successful indie historical authors have proven that that's not really true.
I do think that there is something to be said about the prolific part, though. I do think that that really helps. I mean, I know Christy is very prolific and I'm very, very fast. And I think that may be part. I know it is part of the success is being able to kind of stay ahead of that algorithm and always having something new out that's,
right.
that's of high quality. So, I mean, because that's, you know, that is the other question. I mean, do you consider yourself to be a fast
but
writer?
But if the books were terrible.
Right. It wouldn't work.
I mean,
I don't think it would work.
I mean, people,
like, there would be a certain time period where it would work.
Right.
Where people would go, oh, I just didn't like that one as much as her last 20 books. But I'll buy the next one because readers are on the whole, like they're pretty loyal, you know, they love you. Then it's going to take them a few times to hate you before they go, I don't think I'm going to do this anymore, which
right.
I always kind of feel like sometimes, you know, people just fall out of love with you as a writer and that's okay. But, you know, I think, you know, you might get two or three books where people would keep buying and then they'd just be like, dude, stop. I don't care for this. Your quality has really gone down. So I think
right.
as long as you can balance that, you know, writing to the level that you can still produce something that's a good work. And I think, you know, as a fast writer, when you talk to other fast writers, and again, I don't know, you know, whether you consider yourself fast or slow, but I, like, for, when people are slow writers, they say, I write better when I write more slowly. Mm. And when you're a fast writer, I write better when I write quickly. When I write slow, I just write myself right into corners, and I overthink it, and I take out the parts that I think are bad that are actually good. So I think it's just how your brain works differently, really.
Yeah.
And so it's like my brain works in a way that also happens to help me be more successful, maybe as an indie.
Yes, than, right.
You know, than somebody that has a different way that their brain works, which might fit better with a traditional. But the nice thing is now it all exists for all of us. So all of our brains can be happy.
Right. Right.
Well, as totally. Happy as you can ever be in publishing.
Right. As a tortured writer.
As yes. a tortured soul, exactly. A tortured creative.
No, I write fairly quickly. I write a draft in about 4 months, and the draft that you're like laughing because I'm sure that's you think that's probably slow compared to you, but
for a traditional, I mean, that's the, like that would be, you know, a couple books a year that you could produce, and that's pretty good for a traditional release. I mean, schedule, they're not going to give you much more than that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't write full time. It is
yes, right,
for me, it is like something that I squeeze in the fringes of my life between kids and softball and my day job and, you know, everything else. But yeah, I write a draft in 4 months, and the draft that I turn in is probably 95% of what is published, between, you know, what goes through the editing process.
Yeah.
So I write pretty cleanly. And I could probably, you know, I try to write 1,000 words a day. So could I write more? Yes. But probably not have any quality of life, you know, with my right. family, like outside of that at this point. So that is, but like you said, I write those 1,000 words fairly quickly. And if I try to slow down and think and really like agonize over it, then I'm like, oh, this was garbage.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And the parts, what I find is because I just draft and I don't do a lot of editing while I'm drafting. I mean, just, you know, you look back from the previous day and remind yourself what you're doing, that level of, you know, and then you tweak it maybe a little bit because you can't stop yourself. You have to tweak a little bit. But I don't like retread over the same ground over and over again very often. And mm-hmm. I find that, you know, I'm writing and I'll be like, oh my God, this is the worst. I'm the worst at this. I'm the worst. This is terrible. I'm going to have to fix this so much when we go to editorial. And then when I go back to it, I'm like, oh, no, that was fine.
Right.
You know? And so I wonder how much if I went back and I agonized right then, how much I would pull out still thinking it was terrible.
Yeah.
And not having that like that space where I can look at it with a more sort of critical eye and say, oh, no, this part was actually good. And actually, I dumped all my angst about how terrible it was into it. So it's all fine. You know? But again, I mean, yeah. like that's all like how, because I mean, that's the wonderful thing about doing this. And this is episode 75, by the way, that you are. So
all right.
75 different writers have come on here and talked to me about 75 different ways of doing this. And I
yes,
love it that
right.
we all are so different. Like sometimes
right.
it calls back. Like there are certain things that it sounds like that you do that are similar to what I do, but I'm sure your process is very different, you know? And
I mean,
so
yeah,
there's no
I mean,
right way.
There's no right way. I mean, you just have to like get, you just have to do it, which
yeah.
is.
And that's the worst advice because it's so hard. When people are like, how do you do it? You're like, I don't know. You just do.
It is the worst. I mean, and you know, it's never, it's fun for about the first 10,000 words. And mm-hmm. after that, you're like, oh God.
And then it's really painful.
Like, how many more
And then
more
sometimes
do I have to
those
go?
Last like 15 or 20 are like, woo, like you've got
yes.
to the top of the roller coaster that you tip over then you're just arms up in the air screaming.
Yeah. But I yeah. always, I get to the 50% mark. I finish 50% of the
right
book.
Now.
And then
I want to die. I don't even want to do this anymore.
Totally. Well, that's why at 50%, that is when I send it to my beta readers. So I don't, they never get a full manuscript from them, which is always really funny because they like, you know,
they must be dying.
What happened?
By the time it comes
like,
out.
How is this going to work out?
That's just cruel. You're cruel.
I know. But to me, like, if you can't grab a reader in that first 50% of the book,
yeah.
like, to me, like, that has to be totally solid.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying I don't care about the last half, but, you know, like, I care, like, a little less.
But don't you think, too, that the last half, like, the first half, I mean, do you plot? Are you like a big character builder? Like how, what is your actual process of building? Because I think that really depends on, you know, whether or not the last 50% is harder, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I know the tent poles. I figure out my turning points. So I sort of know. Now, I will tell you that the first book in a series is always harder for me because it's
you don't know
like
anybody.
That, right. 100%.
It's horrifying.
100%.
Who are all these idiots? I don't want to write about them.
Right. And it's the world building. I mean, even though, like, you know, I said in the same time and place, like, I still have to set up, you know,
yeah, because
the
series has a certain cadence to it and flow to it and the way that they interact with each other and the way that the you know, where the houses are and what the things are. And it is that when you start a new series, it's you have to build all that into your thing. Even if you've visited these characters in a different series, you still have
exactly
to figure out where the corners are and the edges are of that world.
100%. So I'm always at the 50% mark thinking it's just the worst piece of garbage ever. And I don't want it to be. My biggest fear in writing is being boring. Like if somebody leaves me a review that is like boring, I
just
want to literally die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just want to die. Like that you could tell me like I didn't like the heroine or, you know, the hero's a jerk or the romance didn't work for me or whatever. But like when I hear boring, I just,
awful.
I just want to like.
Because I mean, if you hate me, that's fine. I mean, that's fine. People are allowed to hate us. If you love me, then that's super nice.
Right.
It's nice when people love you. I mean, I want to have a reaction. I don't want that. Like, it was okay.
Yeah, oh, that's a bad one.
Oh, God.
Meh.
Oh. 3 stars. I have somebody that gives me 3 stars, but then she's always like a glowing review. And I'm like, how do you get 5, though?
Right.
Why am I so confused?
Five is Citizen Kane.
Right. Like, it's like, this is the best thing ever written.
Yeah.
It's not that. So, I mean, it's so much pressure. But no, but it's really true. I mean, that sort of feeling that you've just, and in the middle, I'm stuck. I'm like stuck. And you're slogging and there's talking and it feels like, you know, you're not really building to that big last crescendo of whatever action is happening. And you're not, you know, I mean, the emotions aren't completely boiling to the point where like they love each other, but they can't reveal it or they can't be together or whatever that big, like, you know, they like, they think they're nice and they like each other's butt, you know, like that's
right.
Like,
everything's
like,
going
it
great.
Can be so boring so fast.
So yeah, when I send it to my beta readers, they're always like, do you want me to read for something specific? And I'm always, is it boring? Like, at any point are you bored? So that's always my biggest fear.
Yeah, it is the great nightmare. So is that always how you've written though? I mean, has it always been like kind of figure out what those tent poles are and then leave? It sounds like what you're saying is you, I guess some people call it like a plantster or a whatever, you know.
I'm mostly a pantser. I mean, I know sort of, I don't always know the turning points. The book that I'm just finishing this week, which is basically The Bachelor set in Gilded Age Newport.
Yeah. It's like such a cute idea.
It is. I did not really know. I have the epilogue to write and I don't know what it's going to be. So like, I don't always know the tent poles, and this one I didn't know them as well as some of the other ones. But again, it's that first book in a series, so I feel like it's just always harder. But I pants. I mean, I kind of wing it.
Well, and again, I mean, I don't remember if we talked about this before we started or after, but I think the more that you do that, the more that you know that you can. Like, you know what I mean? Like the first time when you write because I think maybe you stop writing yourself into corners as much. Maybe that's it. You know, is that like, you know what you kind of have to do and how you have to get there. So you don't need as many tent posts because you know how to get to the next place maybe.
Right. Right. Correct.
And it does become easier because I am much more of on the plot end of the pantser, but leaving that elbow room of being able to have someone do something in a way that I didn't expect is really important, because sometimes that's where you find like the best thing. What you think should have happened shouldn't happen. Or what I say to my husband is I'll plot out like the first 10 or 15 or 20 scenes. And then I say, I need to see how they move together. Like how, you know what I mean? Like I've plotted it and I kind of know who they are, but until they actually get into a space together and I see what their banter is like and I see what their interaction is like, then I don't know. Then I feel like I can figure out where how they're going to react better. And that's how I'm going to get my turning points, because my turning points are always going to come from how the characters react, I guess.
Right. Totally. Totally. Yeah. And there's like joy in the discovery.
Yes. I mean, it's so exciting when they do something and I'm like, oh my God, that's how totally. I'm fix everything.
Totally. And I think if I really tried to like pigeonhole that before I started, it would take away some of that joy for me.
It wouldn't work as well for me.
Yeah.
Because I don't know until I know. And if I try to pretend like I know, then it's not going to work.
Yeah. Like a lot of people I know skip ahead and they'll say, yeah. Well, you know, I won't write this scene today. I'll just skip ahead two scenes and write that scene. And I'm like, man, I could never do that.
Yeah. Anytime I've had to, you know, if I'm really, really stuck or I just don't feel like writing a love scene, like I feel so disjointed for like the next 20 pages, then I'm usually just like, oh, screw it. I'll just go back and do it. So,
right.
Because I can't, I don't write out of order either. Yeah. So,
me neither. I mean, I can't really put a placeholder in, because invariably when I come back to write in that placeholder, it's, you know.
Well, you've put yourself in a different emotional place with the characters.
Right.
So now you're like having to back up to where they were before that new emotional place. I mean, I have such respect for people that do it that way.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how you. And then you read the books and they're like beautiful and stunning,
yeah.
And, you know, fantastically made. But it's just, I mean, I sit there and I think, oh my God, like, how do you manage it though? Because,
right.
I mean, I know where my characters are with each other emotionally right now. And it's going to be really different in 50 pages or, you know, 10,000
words. What it boils down to is that I'm just really not that smart. Like I need like to, you know, I need my... to hold my little writerly hand through the entire thing and yeah. really, I'm just not that smart.
I'm sure that is not true. I get the sense from speaking to you for the last 52 minutes that is not true.
Well, but, I don't know.
But again, I mean, I think that that's all, I don't know. That's all part of my process is like feeling like I'm screwing this up is part of the process. Like I can pinpoint, Michael can pinpoint where I am in a manuscript by how much I feel like I'm failing. So maybe yeah, that's just part of the process.
Does he read everything for you?
So since he took over, we say assistant, but it's so much more than that. But since he sort of took over helping on the publishing side of things, he listens to all the books in audio. So he does all the proofreading in the audio. So that's how he reads all my books now, is when they go into audio, nice. He reads them, which is really cool because he's not a giant fiction reader. He's never been. There was a whole conversation that went on Twitter about how, well, if you're a writer and your husband doesn't read your books or your spouse doesn't read your books, then you should dump them. And I was like, why? Like, if he's not into reading, like, he's so supportive in other ways, like, why would I care? But when he's, because I can't listen to my audio, like it makes me feel like I'm gonna break out in hives. I want to die. Like he will sometimes listen to it in his vehicle when we could all go out into the universe. He used to listen to it in his vehicle when he'd go somewhere, and I would go get in the truck and he'd still have it on and be like, please make it stop. I don't want to. Please make it stop. I'm gonna die. My head's gonna explode. So, but that's how he listens, and it's kind of cool because now he's read all my indie books at this point because he's listened to them all on audio.
But, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's nice. I cannot imagine listening to my own audiobook.
It's just...
I know people that do.
Traditionally, like somebody at HarperCollins listens to it or somebody at Kensington listens to it and they get to have that job, which is right. Nice. And so you can just ignore it like a normal person. But, you know, they send me a proof and they're like, anyway, listen to it. And I'm like, mm-mm.
You're like,
no.
Eep.
No, thank you. But someone has to. So
yeah.
So he steps right. up. Does right. your husband still ever step in and help you editorially since that was something that he did? Or has he just like bailed out of the entire ship?
If I have questions, he's usually the first person I go to. If I'm like,
yeah.
What if I, and sometimes I asked him a sex question not that long ago. Like if I were here and, oh, yeah.
Could you just stand this way?
You know, I probably shouldn't get into like the whole setup.
Not too much detail, but I get what you're saying.
You know, there was like a logistics question about, sure. You know, if you didn't know, like, would you know your partner if you didn't see their face? Like, would you know them
if they were doing X?
Yeah, right. And he was like, yes, 100%. Like, I, you know, would know you in the dark, you know, like,
right.
I absolutely would. Any man would know his part, you know. So He is like my first person that I go to either plot questions with or, you know, just to bounce something off of. And he, a lot of times he'll say, no, that's too cliche. Do better. You know,
ow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he will, you know, I've read that a million times.
He's a mean editor.
He keeps it real in my house.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
He reads like a lot of mystery and a lot of thrillers. So he'll be like, no, you know, don't write a pro, you know, don't do this, don't do that. You know, he offers advice. And I don't always listen to him. I mean, he's not a romance reader. He,
right. It's different.
Yeah, it's different. And, I don't always listen to him, but he definitely, if I ever have questions when I'm doing the final page proofs about, is this, comma here, or does this word make sense? Or, yeah. Like he's great with that stuff.
Yeah.
And I have like found, you know, words that like, he'll be like, that word does not mean what you think it means. So like, I'm always grateful for his help when he gives it.
I do have to say that one of the nice things is that because he's not a big reader, because he's listening to audio, like when I catch him getting kind of emotional over the story, I'm like, I did it. Oh, I destroyed him.
That is the best.
Yeah. The first time that he kind of got like choked up, I was like, oh my God, I'm the best writer. I'm Joan Weiler. Which it passed very, very quickly. It went away very quickly. And I was right back to being the worst. But for a second, it was beautiful. So.
Now, has he ever come back to you from listening to the audio and said, you do this a lot or you do that a lot?
No.
Or... No? Okay.
No, I mean, mostly he's listening to, like, you know, make sure that it sounds smooth. It's, you know, I mean, that, like, you know,
yeah.
if a character was in a different book, that the voice actress is using a similar voice so that it's not really, really awkward, or, you know, that kind of thing. If people are listening, especially with those Duke books, all those handsome Dukes, like, they don't, because there's so many of them, and people are, you know, sometimes listen to them boom, 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 right after each other.
Yeah.
So you don't want there to be, like, suddenly now...
It's a new voice.
Has a new accent or a new way of speaking.
Yeah.
Or suddenly my American doesn't have she has a very British accent or something. So
yeah.
Yeah. So it's that kind of stuff. But
when my husband first started reading my manuscripts, he was like, everybody's rolling their eyes and everybody's narrowing their eyes and everybody's gazing with their eyes. Like, maybe think about some other
switching
physical
that up.
Reaction.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's a good note. So now whenever I write something about someone's eyes,
you're like, oh shoot, am I doing it?
I know. Totally.
I find that I have something that is the thing that happens every single book. Like, I'll have a book where everyone is shaking their head a lot, and you know, and my editor will catch that, you know, well, she'd be like, yeah, that's happened like 700 times in this 320 page manuscript, so it might be something you want to look at. Which is fair. That's a fair note. But I mean, I feel like, but it's, I always feel like it's something different. So I don't know. I mean, I get stuck on a word or a phrase or an action or something in every single book. And then that's my action for that book. So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I'm working through them all now because there's so many. So.
Right.
I've run out of, everyone's back to, we come back around to shaking their heads again and it's fine. Like a hinge. Well, in some crazy way, we've actually like talked for an hour, because this is always what happens. But
oh my goodness,
I know. Do you want to tell people about what your most recent or your upcoming something is? What you want them to go and do right now?
Well, The Devil of Downtown is the third book in the Uptown Girls series, and it comes out on June 30th. So it's probably out already by the time this out. So
yes, it'll have just come out, so everyone go buy that.
Oh yay. So yeah, that's the last book in the Uptown Girls series. It's the youngest sister, Justine Green, who's the do-gooder, who ends up with Jack Mulligan, who is the criminal kingpin of New York City.
That's my favorite pairing.
Thank you.
Like, I'm the very best girl and I am literally the worst boy. It's like the best.
Right. Yeah.
It's all my catnip. I'll go pre-order that right now.
Yes.
Excellent. And then are you starting a new series then after? I mean, obviously you are, but I mean, is that...
Yeah, so the next series is the Fifth Avenue Rebels, and it starts in spring of 2021 with The Heiress Hunt is the first book.
Oh, fun.
And it is, yeah, it's like the Bachelor set in Newport, Rhode Island.
Oh, right. Oh,
in the Gilded Age. So, yeah, hopefully it's not boring. That's all I'm saying.
Everybody.
I'm sure. Hopefully people will let me know.
Now that people know that this is your kryptonite.
It totally.
Shoot.
Totally.
We've revealed too much.
Anybody who wants to mess with me is going to start leaving.
I'll just delete this whole thing. Well, it never happened. Well, thank you again for doing this. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.